Hi, and welcome to the magazine Rack on Chris. I'm June Holliday. Today I'll be reading from the March-April 2024 issue of Reader's Digest. Let's begin with a story of a hero pet entitled Kit, the Courageous Canine. Officer Bill Cushing needed a partner. His dog needed a purpose. Together they rescued each other. By David Wedge, from Boston Magazine. Bill Cushing was exercising in his home gym when he got the call. It was a little before 1 p.m. on June 4th, 2021, and the Braintree, Massachusetts police officer thought he could get a workout in before his shift started. When Cushing suddenly heard sirens, though, and his phone lit up with the Braintree Police Department number, he knew his day was about to start early. A domestic violence call had come in, and the department needed Cushing and Kit, his police dog for the past decade, to help find the suspect. Cushing rushed to put on his uniform. Kit, an 11-year-old German Shepherd, Belgian Malinois mix, snapped to attention. It was time to go to work. Cushing drove toward the scene on McCusker Drive, listening to the radio chatter and speeding up as he heard the action escalate. The suspect possibly had two firearms, was on foot, and had fled into the woods behind a massive apartment complex. Cushing knew the spot. Those woods had been the site of many police incidents where he and Kit had tracked assailants in the past. By the time Cushing whipped into the parking lot at the edge of the woods, other officers were there, one directing Cushing and Kit to the last known spot where the fugitive had been seen. Kit immediately picked up the scent, and they were off, charging into the brush. Kit tugged forcefully at his leash, almost dragging Cushing into a sprint. Soon, Kit leaped toward a large rock, which let Cushing know that behind it, the armed man they were after was hiding and ready to pounce. 10 years earlier, on a warm July day in 2011, Cushing climbed into the van with Mark O'Reilly, the master canine trainer from the Massachusetts Department of Correction. They headed toward a police dog training center in Bethany, Connecticut. Cushing didn't yet know much about being a canine officer. He'd been a beat cop for the past 6 years, but now in his early 30s, he wanted more action and to make a greater contribution to keeping his hometown safe. He believed that becoming a canine officer was the way to do it. Not every cop can become a canine officer. Candidates need to be hardworking, incredibly fit, and most of all, catch the attention of the police chief. Once officers are selected, they must undergo hundreds of hours of specialized training before getting to work with a dog. It's an elite circle. At the training facility, Cushing and O'Reilly emerged from their vehicle to a chorus of dogs barking inside the long white building. One of the facility's trainers came out with a dog for their inspection. His name was Kit. Kit was a mangy-looking mutt with matted hair, big pointy ears that stood straight up, and a funny look in his eye. Cushing didn't like what he saw. O'Reilly, though, wasn't paying attention to Kit's looks, but to the way he strode out of his kennel as though he belonged. He was just 11 months old and hadn't been trained to track scents. Yet he immediately spotted a 5-gallon bucket with some toys in it. He attacked the bucket with a vengeance, toppling it over and thrashing it around. "We'll take him," O'Reilly said. "Ah, geez," Cushing thought. Now this funny-looking dog with no tracking experience was coming home with him. The next 16 weeks served as a boot camp for Cushing and Kit. Each morning, the pair headed out for intensive 8 to 12-hour training sessions, tracking through vast fields, empty buildings, and surrounding forests. O'Reilly told Cushing that he had to learn to trust his dog, even when Cushing had his doubts. Still, the most important part of the training took place at home. Cushing learned that for their partnership to be successful, Kit needed to believe that Cushing was the only person who would provide him with food and water, and that his own survival depended on Cushing's safety. So for the first few weeks, Cushing fed Kit only by hand. He would serve him a water bowl, and if Kit didn't drink, he would remove it. Cushing became everything to Kit. It was mutual. Cushing didn't have a wife, girlfriend, or children. Kit was the focus of his profession, his home life, and his affection. About halfway through their training, Cushing and Kit went to the prison complex for a long, challenging tracking test. A trainer, posing as a suspect clad in a protective bite suit, hid hundreds of yards away. Kit picked up his scent and aggressively pursued. When he spotted the trainer, Kit leaped at him, flying 10 feet through the air and nearly knocking him down to the ground. "Whoa," Cushing thought, "this dog actually works." "Congratulations," O'Reilly told Cushing. "You're cleared hot," which meant that Kit was ready to hit the streets. Kit and Cushing's first assignment was to track a bank robber. Kit picked up a scent at the bank and led Cushing down the road where they discovered some cash that the robber had dumped before fleeing in a getaway car. Kit's discovery helped other officers pick up the trail and capture the robber. Many successful assignments followed. Sometimes, when the tracks were long and grueling, Cushing wondered if Kit was still on the scent. Then he would hear O'Reilly's voice in his head, "Trust your dog." So Cushing did, and Kit never let him down. Cushing soon grew to rely on Kit in other ways, too. If Cushing had a personal problem, he'd talk to Kit about it. If Cushing was having a rough day, Kit would intuitively rest his head on him. Before Cushing knew it, Kit wasn't just his partner. They were best friends. In the early hours of a March day in 2016, Cushing was asleep when his phone rang. It was his lieutenant. A man had allegedly threatened the mother of his two children and was on the loose, drunk and carrying a knife. "We need you and Kit to find this guy," the lieutenant ordered. Kit was already up and standing at attention. He seemed to sense that they were going to work. Kit barked as they drove with sirens screaming and lights flashing toward the neighborhood where the suspect had last been seen. When they arrived, Kit picked up the scent of his target, 44-year-old Robert Dussord. Kit then led Cushing and other officers through several backyards and onto a street where Kit stopped and attempted to dive under a parked car. The officers then knew that was where the man they were after was hiding. Cushing gripped Kit's leash in his left hand, shining his flashlight underneath the vehicle to see the fugitive. The round beam of light passed over Dussord's face. "Come out, man," Cushing said to Dussord. Silence. "Hey, buddy, I don't want my dog to bite you," Cushing added. "Just come out. Give up." Kit sat still, riveted, waiting for Cushing's command to pounce. Then Dussord poked his head up from under the car and looked directly at him. Dussord allegedly said, "I'm going to kill you." An instant later, the suspect darted out from under the car, pulled a large kitchen knife out of his pants, and advanced toward Cushing and Kit. "Drop the knife," Cushing recalls yelling. "My dog's going to bite you." Dussord kept moving toward them, leaving Cushing no choice. He released his grip on the leash. Kit leaped through the air and sank his teeth into the suspect's right hip. Dussord wailed and began flailing his knife. Cushing was terrified that he would stab Kit. Enraged, Dussord advanced, stabbing at the air just inches from Cushing. Cushing sensed it was a shoot or be killed situation, but feared he might strike Kit while trying to hit the suspect. He fired two quick rounds, and Dussord fell to the ground with Kit still biting him. Cushing rushed over and grabbed Kit around the neck to release his bite. Other officers immediately attempted CPR on Dussord, but it was too late. Dussord later died at the hospital. Wanting to make sure that Dussord hadn't stabbed Kit, Cushing inspected the dog's body for injuries. When he found none, he bear-hugged Kit, burying his face in his fur. "Good boy, Kit," he said. "We're good. We're good." Just a month after the shooting, Cushing and Kit found themselves in the same neighborhood tracking another domestic violence suspect. Cushing was on high alert. His breathing was heavy and his heart pounded. When Cushing stepped on a tree branch and it snapped, he drew his weapon. Another officer turned to look at him and asked if Cushing was okay. Cushing had assured his chief that he was ready to return to work. But now, back in the field, drawing his gun at imaginary bad guys, it was obvious to Cushing that he wasn't okay at all. Over and over again, he replayed in his head what had happened the night he'd killed Dussord. He was sure he had done everything right, but he couldn't stop thinking about Dussord's children who had lost their father. Cushing knew he needed help. He began going to a therapist. He also consulted Kit's veterinarian, who said that Cushing's emotions were traveling right down the leash into Kit. Cushing knew he had to work hard to heal, not just for his own sake, but also for Kit's. After several weeks of therapy, they went back to work and continued to excel. Then, in 2018, Cushing started dating a woman. She moved in with Cushing and Kit, and in June 2019, their daughter was born. Cushing worried that Kit might react poorly to a baby in the house, in their house. After all, Kit was so protective of Cushing and their territory. But just as Kit had seemed to feel Cushing's fear and trauma, Kit seemed to also feel his love. Kit played with the baby. She fell asleep resting on him. He wouldn't let anyone other than Cushing and his girlfriend near her. As for Cushing, he took to parenting like a natural. After all, Kit had taught him how to care for another being, how to nurture, and how to put someone else's needs before his own. As parenting became a priority, Cushing began to work less. In 2020, Cushing and his girlfriend welcomed their second daughter, and that meant turning down even more assignments. Soon after, the call for McCusker Drive came in. On June 4th, 2021, Kit yanked Cushing through thorny woods with two other officers, Richard Siebert and Matthew Donahue, following. They were chasing 34-year-old Andrew Holman after a woman had called the police, saying he had tried to choke her and put a gun to her head before fleeing. Cushing could tell by the purpose with which Kit was pulling him that Holman was hiding somewhere nearby. Suddenly, Kit stopped and jumped up and down near a 4-foot-tall rock. Kit was telling him Holman was behind it. "Show me your hands," Cushing shouted. "Show me your hands." Holman emerged with his gun drawn. "Drop the gun," one officer shouted. Kit leaped at Holman, aiming to sink his teeth into him so Cushing could make the arrest. Instead, Holman fired 3 times and Kit flew backward, landing on the ground. Cushing raised his weapon, fired at Holman, and thought he had hit him. Holman doubled over and started backing up, but continued firing at the officers who fired back at him. Cushing ran out of bullets. He tried to reload, but couldn't move his left arm. When he looked down, he knew why. It looked like his arm had been partially blown off. "I'm hit," he shouted before falling onto the ground next to Kit. Siebert unleashed a volley of shots from his rifle at Holman. Pop, pop, pop. The woods suddenly went quiet. Holman was mortally wounded, and Cushing was still lying on the ground, his left arm in searing pain. He recalls turning his head to the side to find himself face to face with Kit. He stared into his best friend's eyes and watched as the life drained out of them. Cushing feared he wasn't far behind. He thought of his young daughters. If he died, they wouldn't remember him. Then Siebert tied a tourniquet around Cushing's arm. "He shot my dog," Cushing told him. "He's gone, Bill," Siebert said. Cushing heard the unmistakable sound of police gear clinking and clanking. Officers placed Cushing onto a stretcher as they carried him out of the woods and loaded him into an ambulance. Cushing saw an officer crying. The door slammed, sirens blared, and the driver sped toward the hospital. Staring at the ceiling, Cushing tried to focus. He thought of his daughters. "I'm still alive," he told himself. "I'm not going to die." 1 week later, after undergoing a handful of reconstructive surgeries, Cushing went home with his left arm in a sling and a full police procession. When they pulled into the driveway, Cushing had to work up the nerve to enter his home. Everything was still there. Kit's bowl, the bed that still smelled like Kit, dog hair on the couch, everything but Kit himself. 10 days later, an officer drove Cushing to the Cartwright Funeral Home in Braintree. Staff escorted Cushing into the viewing room, where Kit's body lay in a coffin draped in an American flag. Cushing pulled up a chair and sat down, lowering his head onto Kit's body, and wept. For one last time, it was just the two of them. Cushing thanked his partner for everything he had done for him, including taking those first bullets and buying the officers precious extra seconds that had saved Cushing's life. Then he wiped his tears. It was time for Kit's final send-off. Dozens of police from across the state watched as six canine officers, led by O'Reilly, placed the dog's casket into the back of a hearse. A procession of police vehicles slowly made its way to Gillette Stadium, where O'Reilly and the other pallbearers carried Kit's casket onto the turf, which was painted with a large white message that read, "K9 Kit, end of watch, 6-4-21. As taps solemnly echoed across the stadium, officers removed the flag from Kit's casket, folded it into a tight, neat triangle, and presented it to Cushing. Then all the officers lined up and paid their respects to Kit. In the months that followed, Cushing began the long process of rehabbing his left arm, unable to do his job without full use of his limb. Instead of pouring his energy into Kit and police work, he opened a foundation in Kit's name. It provides canine teams with protective gear, including bulletproof vests for dogs, in hopes of saving the life of a canine as brave as Kit. What a great story. Let's change gears a bit and switch to health. Here's an article entitled, "Let's Dance. It's Good for Your Body, Soul, and Even Your Brain," by Claire Ciboni. Wearing all black and sitting on a tufted white ottoman in her sunlit living room, Sarah Robichaud is teaching a routine inspired by modern ballet to 80 students on Zoom. The Bolshoi-trained dancer spreads her arms wide in exaggerated movements to a slow cover of the Proclaimers' "I'm Gonna Be 500 Miles" as her students get into the groove. "We're just going to start with a gentle, gentle sway back and forth," Robichaud says to the group. "I want you to think that there's a thread attached to your wrist and someone's pulling that thread from side to side." Many of her students are seated as well. More than half of them have Parkinson's disease, and typically movement can be very difficult. But when they try to mirror her fluid and graceful movements, a look of ease comes over them. "Growing evidence shows that dancing can boost brain health and help manage symptoms of neurocognitive and movement disorders, including Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, dementia, and brain injury. For example, a 2021 York University study showed that weekly dance training improved motor function and daily living for those with mild to moderate Parkinson's. This piggybacks on other findings that show how activities that target balance, coordination, flexibility, creativity, and memory work can improve Parkinson's symptoms. Robichaud started Dancing with Parkinson's in 2007 as a way to give back to her community. A few years later, her grandfather was diagnosed with the disease. Robichaud was able to dance with him in his long-term care home until his final days. The compassion and care that I have for our dancers is that they're all my grandfather, she says. Recently, one of her students, a man in his 50s who had been adamant that dancing wasn't for him, said that he now has more dexterity in his hands and generally moves more freely. I can't deny how this is changing my life, he told her. So what is it about dance that's different from a brisk walk or other aerobic exercises? Helena Blumen, a cognitive scientist at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City, says the intricate mental multitasking that dance requires engages various parts of the brain at the same time, which can lead to the strengthening of neural connections across different regions. Basically, dancing requires more brain power than simpler repetitive exercises. It's socially demanding, cognitively demanding, physically demanding, she says. Anyone who's ever felt the irresistible urge to sway to a favorite song knows that combining music and movement can lift your mood and melt away stress. But there's a lot more happening in your brain when you're trying to follow even the easiest choreography. In dance, we have to learn patterns. We have to think symmetrically and asymmetrically. We have to remember sequences, says David Leventhal, program director at the Mark Morris Dance for PD program where Robichaud trained. The effect extends beyond dance class to the real world. Tasks like navigating the kitchen or walking to the bus stop can become more attainable if they are regarded as choreography. While scientists are still learning how the mechanisms of dance work in the brain, a clearer picture is beginning to emerge. In 2018, researchers at Otto von Guericke University in Magdeburg, Germany, did MRI scans of older adults who had participated in one of two programs over a six-month period. One group practiced dance and the other did traditional exercise program with cycling and strength training. While both groups improved their level of physical fitness, the dancers grew more white and gray matter in the parts of the brain responsible for cognitive processes, such as working memory, attention, and high-level thinking. Both white and gray matter typically decline as we get older, making communication in the brain lag and certain cognitive tasks, such as multitasking and problem solving, tougher. Together, the researchers hypothesize these brain changes contribute to more neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to form new connections and pathways. Imagine your brain is like a city with loads of roads and pathways. Brain plasticity is akin to the city's ability to build new roads, repair old ones, or even change the direction of traffic based on how often the routes are used and what the city needs. So just as cities adapt and change over time to meet the needs of their residents, our brains can reshape and adjust based on our experiences and learning. What's more, the dance group showed an increase in blood plasma BDNF, a protein that plays a crucial role in developing brain plasticity. In a 2022 study, Blumen and other researchers from Albert Einstein College of Medicine found that social ballroom dancing was associated with reduced atrophy in the hippocampus, a brain region that is key to memory functioning and is particularly affected by Alzheimer's disease. The dancers were compared with other adults over the age of 65 who walked on a treadmill. In other words, the dancers' memory center isn't shrinking as quickly, improving their overall quality of life and potentially reducing the risk of dementia. Similar studies have shown the benefits of dance for people with conditions ranging from MS and Huntington's disease to autism and depression. Dance therapy might even help people with brain injuries. A Finnish study of people with severe traumatic brain injury showed that dance-based rehabilitation might improve mobility, cognition, and overall well-being. In addition to the physical and neurological benefits, dance can also help people accept what their bodies can and can't do, making it easier to live with the diseases they have. Dance is about befriending the body, says Erica Hornthal, a Chicago-based dance and movement therapist and author of Body Aware, Rediscover Your Mind-Body Connection, Stop Feeling Stuck, and Improve Your Mental Health with Simple Movement Practices. Rather than trying to control or fix our bodies, dance helps us to meet ourselves where we are, she says. Donya Baines, 44, was diagnosed with MS in 2006 after her body went numb from the chest down. Today, her hands are still numb and she suffers from severe muscle tightness and balance issues, which makes standing and walking difficult. She recently joined an online dance program for people with MS offered by the University of Florida. Not only has it improved her coordination and range of motion, it has also helped her overcome her fear of being judged for how she moves in the class and out in the world. To see other people moving like I'm moving, she says, and know that I don't have to be professional and super technical in my dancing or make sure my leg lifts this way, it made me comfortable with where I am right now. Dancing with others makes people feel less different, and it helps combat the loneliness and isolation of living with a chronic illness. Allowing those broader connections is one of the reasons that programs initially intended only for people with Parkinson's and MS have opened up to everyone. For many people, Leventhal says, dance has become vital to their quality of life. They've come to rely on it in a way that has an essential part of their Parkinson's management. It's not an extra thing that they do because they like to do it, he says. Since he started teaching more than 22 years ago, the Dance for PD model has been adopted by 300 communities in 28 countries around the world. Some, including India and South Korea, have incorporated their own cultural dance styles into the class model. Still, researchers say they're only scratching the surface of understanding how dance can be used therapeutically. Larger studies are needed to confirm the findings of the smaller trials that have been done so far. Additional studies are also needed to pinpoint the most effective types of dance movements and the optimal length and frequency of classes. It's also unclear who, in terms of age or disease progression, would benefit the most. Those who aren't drawn to dance might want to try doing other brain-stimulating physical activities, such as Tai Chi or yoga, says Notker Müller, a health sciences professor at the University of Potsdam, who co-authored the study at Otto von Guericke University. And for people who are timid about dancing in front of others, online classes make it easy to dance at home, like no one is watching. Many Zoom participants leave their cameras off. Robichaud's mission is to create a sense of community, so much so that she sometimes takes her Dancing with Parkinson's program on the road and teaches the class from dancers' homes. Wherever she teaches, her message is one of hope. We want you to feel joyful, to get more involved in your community, to explore the limitless possibilities for the rest of your life. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the March-April 2024 issue of Reader's Digest. I'm June Holliday. So long until next time.